Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Let's get started, members. We have a fairly long agenda. And Senator Fredrickson, welcome to that end of the table.
Well, Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. The bill that I bring before you is Senate File 1080, and it very simply would appropriate a little over $92,000 to the Minnesota River Joint Powers Board. The board's also known as the Minnesota River Board. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about the Minnesota River. The Minnesota River covers 16,770 square miles of area, and of that, almost 15,000 square miles is in Minnesota. It's all are part of 37 counties, and there is a map up here that gives an area. It shows you the area of the state that the river covers, and there's also a handout with maps and some photos for your information. The Minnesota River Basin is 18.5% of the state's geographical size, and it's 29% of the state's cultivated acres. When the Minnesota River flows into the Mississippi River, it increases the flow of the Mississippi River by 47%. The Minnesota River watershed is divided into 13 major watersheds that comprise, and there are watersheds like the Cottonwood River, Redwood River, Blue Earth River, Le Sueur River, plus several others. The Minnesota River has carried sediment and pollutants in an increasing amount up to probably the mid-80s or late 80s. When there was a comprehensive assessment done by PCA of the Minnesota River, and a result of that was a plan to clean up the Minnesota River. It received a lot of attention in the early 1990s. We, the state, have concentrated on doing that. CREP is a good example of that. Our targeting of RIM to cleaning up the Minnesota River is a good example. Many examples of how we've tried to move forward to clean up the Minnesota River. Along with that effort was an agreement between the state and the 37 affected counties to form a state-county partnership to help assist with this cleanup effort. That occurred in 1996, and for several years after 1996, the state upheld our part of the deal by appropriating a small amount of money to the Minnesota River Board. A few years ago, that state support went away. We were not able to maintain it. I tried hard to maintain it, but was not successful. So as a result of that, the counties have had to rely entirely on property tax, entirely on their own levies to sustain this Joint Powers Minnesota River Board effort. And quite frankly, they've struggled because of that, partly because they haven't had quite enough money to do the things they'd like to do, and partly because of the sense, well, the state of Minnesota isn't putting any money into this anymore. Therefore, it isn't as important as if we would continue that partnership. So what this bill would do would appropriate a small amount of money again to the Minnesota River Board so that the state would do our share in that partnership and we would continue with this important effort. And, Madam Chair, I have a witness with me today, and I'd like to have Dr. Shannon Fisher introduce himself and give you more information about the Minnesota River Board and also the Minnesota State University Mankato Water Resource Center.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shannon Fisher, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota River Board. I also hold the position of Director of the Water Resources Center at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I'm also a faculty in the biology department there as well. In the handout that you have in front of you, I think Senator Fredrickson did a nice job of giving a great history of where the board has been and what some of the challenges have been facing us over the last 5 to 10 years. And in 1995, we were created under an auspice of joint relationship. And for the last few years, we have been struggling, as Senator Fredrickson said, to maintain a sufficient amount of funding through county dues collections, and it has been a challenge. When the Minnesota River Board was brought to fruition, On page 2 on the bottom of the handout of the 5-page stapled handout, there is a Free Press article that can demonstrate or just shows that this thing hit the front page of the paper, and it was a really big deal. The pact was indicated by then-Governor Arne Carlson as one of the most important documents in Minnesota history. Now, that may have been a little bit of an elaboration, but nonetheless, for southern Minnesota and our watershed, this was a very, very important document. I just want to give you a little bit of background on the board and what we are trying to accomplish. The top of page 3, there are three statements. There's our mission statement, our vision statement, and our goal statement. The purpose of the board has been to provide leadership and build partnerships and support efforts to improve and protect water quality in the Minnesota River Basin. Building partnerships has been a very important part of what we do, but that we feel it's important that we can only do our job in terms of preservation and restoration of the Minnesota River Valley through cooperative efforts, and so therefore we really focus on those partnerships. The goal ultimately is the restoration and preservation, or at least the conservation, of the Minnesota River's recreational habitat and scenic beauty by leveraging existing resources at several levels. And so we try to approach this from various points of funding, various points of policy delivery. The executive committee, along with all of the delegates for the board, include a number of county commissioners. I am a half-time executive director for the board. We also have an assistant director who handles a lot of our clerical and administrative duties, and she is a 0.15 FTE, and so we are managing the board on a 0.65 FTE staffing. On the top of page 4, you can see the general structure of the Minnesota River Board organization. We come in kind of three parts. There's the Minnesota River Board itself, which includes the county commissioners, and we try to work on policy, and we try to do our best to keep this thing moving forward. We also have two very important groups of partners, though. One is the watershed programs themselves through various entities, which may include watershed districts, groups like Area 2, watershed projects, and water county planners. The Water Resources Center has also become a critical partner in the Minnesota River Board's structure. Through the university relationship, with the Water Resources Center being nested within Minnesota State University Mankato, we have been able to really solidify and stabilize a lot of the workings of the board by giving ourselves access to a much broader range of resources and providing a structure in which the board can operate to handle funding and staffing. During 2006, the board took a step back and decided it was time to take a look at the statute that created us and try to determine whether or not we are accomplishing the statutory goals that that were put in place. So we then went through and evaluated all of those statutory obligations, and we have provided a document or created a document that summarizes that information. On the top of page 5, I'm not going to go through the list, but it's become relatively extensive on what the Minnesota River Board has achieved over the last few years. The Procedures Guide and Strategic Plan was only one point of our success over the last couple of years. We've also been heavily involved in clean water legacy funding coordination. We are working hard with the Pollution Control Agency and a number of private partners and farm organizations to get a nutrient trading network established for the southern part of the state. We continue to work on conservation funding and integrated watershed modeling, drainage education and evaluation, and we have also started handling many of the tillage transect survey duties. But I think one of the highlighting, the real ideal situation for the board is the Lake Crystal Clean Water Partnership. This was a situation where the Minnesota River Board was able to bring appropriate partners together and help a small city who did not have the resources or the grant writing capacity to get the job done. And we were able to bring $320,000 into this group at basically limited benefit to the board financially. But that's the kind of relationship that we would like to see the board have across the basin. The Middle Minnesota River Septic Initiative was another one. Both of these received some Clean Water Legacy Act funding, and the Lake Crystal Clean Water Partnership was also very successful with 319 funding. Another one that the Minnesota River Board has been highly active in is the Minnesota River Summit. We brought together with partners across the basin more than 180 participants this last year to talk about the river and talk about where we want to go with the river. And it was a very successful summit and one that we hope will bear fruit in years to come. So to summarize, the board is really quite active, but we'd like to do more. We would like to do more with county water plant integration. We would like to have a watershed staff member who can do more outreach and more training for watershed project coordinators, for watershed district staff, for soil and water conservation district staff. We want to be able to provide greater levels of assistance in grant writing and grant management for members of our stakeholders in the basin. We are very open to continuing a role, an active role, in Clean Water Legacy Act coordination. We believe in watershed-based management and feel it's very important for us to be involved in that capacity. And partnership building, as I said, is a very important role to us, as well as serving as an LGU and watershed voice. We support projects, and we do not want to compete with them, and that has been a problem. Finding administrative dollars to support our work has been a real challenge. We can write projects, and we can obtain projects because we have the capacity and the resources to do so. However, we find ourselves in conflict with our own watersheds and watershed projects in the terms that we are then competing with them for limited resources, and we would rather be working for them rather than against them. On the second handout, I'm not going to go through the – there's a Minnesota River Board, and I think the subtitle summarizes it. We've entered into a new era of leadership, partnership, and support. And there's just a couple of bulleted lists there that I would encourage you to just kind of glance through in terms of what has the board done lately and what could we do with the state appropriation. There's a lot that we could do with the state appropriation, and the budget on the legal size sheet on the back of the smaller stapled handout on the left-hand column, the line items expenses are identified. In the middle column is our 2007 approved budget, and then on the right-hand column is a desired FY08 budget that we would greatly appreciate some assistance with through the request for the $92,108. A couple of the highlights there would be an increase in staffing. One of our greatest limitations right now is simply having good quality staff in place that have the time and the resources to actually go out and work with the stakeholders in the basin. And that would increase, basically we would add one full-time position and increase our assistant director by 0.2 FTE. Along with that would come a substantial increase in the amount of programming dollars, and travel has also been a big issue for us. We've only been able to maintain about a $1,700 per year travel budget, and we would need more than $5,000 to sufficiently travel across the basin, meet with the people we should be meeting with, and build the partnerships that we desire to build. The counties are not asking for handouts, so to speak. They are asking for a partnership. They're asking for support from the state. The counties are continuing to raise funds, and they have been basing all of our funding on county dues for the last 5 years. In the preferred scenario on the bottom right-hand side, a 25% increase in base dues from the counties would likely be acceptable to those counties. However, we would also need some additional money from the state through the general fund, Clean Water Legacy Act, et cetera, some type of funding resource. And we will also continue to write grants, and we are currently involved in several grant processes. So with that, I am concluding my comments and be open to answering any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Fisher. So the state funding ended in 2001.
Madam Chair, I believe that's when it ended, yeah.
And so the budget that you've laid out here, that's your current budget, is that roughly what you've been existing on for the last 6 years?
Madam Chair, the budget of $67,200 for our calendar year 2007 budget is actually a slight increase over the past 4 years. And the reason for that is because I managed to sway enough of the counties to add in some supplemental dues this past year. And so they increased their base dues to provide a little bit of additional. But we have been operating on a budget for the last 5 years between $55,000 and $65,000.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, when this board was formed, the Joint Powers Board was formed among the counties, and we, the state, said that we would be in partnership with them and provide a certain amount of funding to carry on their programs. And I think the organization has suffered because the state contribution went to zero. sort of like the state was not holding up our share of the partnership. And some of the counties, quite honestly, kind of resent that a little. And I think that affects the county's willingness to, some of the county's willingness to raise their dues or to contribute money to the organization. I think a state appropriation now would go a long ways towards enhancing and revitalizing what this board does. And they do a lot of important activities.
Do you know if there's any other watersheds or areas that have these kinds of boards, joint boards over their watershed similar to this, or is this the only one in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, there's a Mississippi Headwaters Board. I'm not sure if they have exactly the same type of mission. This is the largest watershed in the state of Minnesota. It's almost 20% of the geographical size of the state. That's why when Dr. Fisher was telling us their travel budget, I was thinking of driving from St. Paul, the confluence of the Mississippi, Minnesota River, out to Big Stone Lake, you know, and trying to coordinate the various watersheds. There's a lot of logistics involved.
So you're looking for a chunk of state money that's actually more than what your overall budget is. So, I mean, are you anticipating then that, I think you suggested that you think county funding would go up if we were able to come up with some state funding?
Madam Chair, I believe that the counties will contribute at a higher level if the state funding comes through. And there's a couple of ways that I would address that. One is that I think if the state funding was appropriated, it would renew some faith in the state's partnership on this board. And I think the 25% increase, at least in base dues, would not be an issue. But I think the other manner in which we would be able to increase revenues from the counties would be that we have had a few counties that have dismissed themselves from full participation in the board. And a lot of that came because of financial reasons. They did not feel that the state was holding up its part of the partnership. They also did not feel that they were being asked to contribute too much. And there were a number of counties that did exit the board. However, we still speak on behalf of them, and I firmly believe that there are several of those counties that would come back to the board if a state appropriation was granted.
Okay. Mr. Knopf points out that there was language, I don't know if that was session laws or statute that says that this board, their goal is to, do you want to read it?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, this was there was money, I think, in the 95 bill for the Joint Powers Board, but they were actually placed in statute in 1996. And it's the Minnesota River Basin Joint Powers Board. It says the Minnesota River Basin Joint Powers Board established under 471-59 is a joint powers for the purpose of coordinating efforts to improve water quality in the Minnesota River and achieving the goal of making the Minnesota River suitable for fishing and swimming by the year 2005, has the following duties, and then it lists the number of duties of the board under statute.
So I think that's helpful to put it in perspective, going back a little bit of, I guess we're past 2005 by 2 years. How are you guys doing on your goals?
Well, Madam Chair, the progress is being made. There are indicators. The Water Resources Center produces a State of the Minnesota River Report annually, and it's a very difficult trend to identify. But in the 6 years of good quality data that we have for the basin, there are a number of indicators that are suggesting that water quality measures are improving. There have been over 100,000 acres of CREP land put in place, and these are going to take some time to have an impact. The river was severely degraded over 125-plus years, and it's not going to be – the 2005 goal was not a realistic goal to set, and it is going to take a lot longer than that for the river to see significantly notable improvements.
So what progress – I mean, are you getting anywhere near fishable and swimmable waters?
Madam Chair, absolutely. There are fish species. I'll give one example. There are fish species such as paddlefish that had been rarely seen in the river, and over the last 2 years, we have seen a number of these fish species come back to the river. There have been numerous documentations of these fish species, along with several other relatively sensitive species. And although the water quality data suggest only marginal changes, the biological data are suggesting that shifts are occurring.
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that more figuratively without quite the detail Dr. Shannon has. From what I've observed and what I've heard, the water quality of the Minnesota River has substantially increased from its origin down to Mankato. But when it gets to Mankato, when the Blue Earth River empties into it, the Le Sueur River, and then the lower third of the Minnesota River, the river again picks up a significant load of pollutants and sediments.
And so do those other water, the tributaries, are they part of your work, or you just focus on the Minnesota River itself?
Madam Chair, we work with all of the entire watershed basin. I would also like to point out, too, that you know one of the reasons that the counties feel strongly about state support on this, on our efforts, is the fact that the goings-on in the Minnesota River Basin in terms of water quality are much bigger and broader than just our basin. The Minnesota River Basin has been identified as one of the significant contributors of pollutants to the Lake Pepin sediment issue. We have been identified as one of the highest nitrate contributors to the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. These are big issues that we can continue to work on, but the counties are really feeling that they can't do it on their own.
Well, I think we recognize how important it is to focus efforts on cleaning up this area, the watershed. I guess we just need to be reassured that putting money in administrative purposes is going to deliver the outcomes in terms of cleaning in clean water. It's not just going to be talk and meetings and, you know, office work. It's going to actually deliver some outcomes. So that's kind of a challenge that we, you know, if 2005 isn't a realistic goal, maybe you can give us a revised goal.
Madam Chair, the challenge that we have in the basin is getting good staff in place. And in order for us to do that, we need to have a relatively stable funding source so that we aren't turning people over regularly. And I see that as one of the greatest challenges. If you look across the basin on where we have had our greatest successes, it is because we have dedicated staff who have been in place for long periods of time. And unfortunately, finding administrative dollars to get those staff in place to assist with many of the projects that we need to do is a very challenging task.
So, Senator Fredrickson, I assume you're requesting ongoing funding for this, not one time?
Madam Chair, I would prefer ongoing.
Okay.
But if there's, I know there's a limited amount of ongoing. If ongoing isn't available, we would certainly take one time.
Well, just be
back 2 years from now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be both pots of money are going to be very, very limited. Just
Madam Chair, I understand.
Yeah. Any other questions, Senator Fredrickson? Would you like to move?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1080 be recommended to pass and laid aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, great. If there's no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Chair members, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins, is she still in the room?
She's,
yes.
Thanks.
Okay,
you miss her. I know. Oh, there she is. I was looking for pink. I know there was some pink.
Yeah. Pink much this session. I feel bad about that.
It's a gray day. We need pink.
Madam Chair, we have another handout here,
okay,
too. When you have time. Madam Chair, I look around the table and I think pretty much everybody has heard lots of discussions about the e-waste bill over the past few years. Senator Rummel is new, so try and not gloss over everything.
Senator Higgins,
yes.
I have connections.
Do have connections, so you probably know as much about it as I do. Madam Chair and members, this is the fifth year I have brought this committee the e-waste bill. I'm thinking this might be the year we actually get this thing enacted into law and set up a process for recycling electronic waste here in the state of Minnesota. Members, you have some handouts, and I would like to call your attention to the County E-Waste Survey. The AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties, polled all of the counties in the state, and they got 100% participation back in this report. So you will be able to look at your individual counties and see what's going on there in terms of the quantity of units or pounds collected, how your local units finance their e-waste program, whether they even have an e-waste program, how much illegal dumping they have found. We know that that's a big issue. And other things, other comments that they have put in here. We have 12 counties in the state who do no electronic waste recycling. And this bill will really help those counties because it will help set up and pay for a mechanism for them to start doing the recycling of this waste. And Madam Chair and members, you all know that for every television or computer monitor, there's about 8 pounds of hazardous waste. And so when we banned these devices from the landfills last year, it has been really apparent to the counties that we can no longer just slide on this issue, that we really do need a statewide system for collecting the e-waste. Madam Chair, I don't know how much detail you actually want about the bill or whether you just want us to talk through the money.
Well, you know, the very short version of the bill is all we need.
Okay, we bring
the policy.
We set up a mechanism to bring money in to pay for the electronic waste recycling, and then that money goes out to the counties to help with their program. How's that for a short?
That was short. Wow, you've been practicing this. Well, okay.
There are a couple of mechanisms to bring money into the program. The first is a registration fee. We figure about 120 manufacturers will register in Minnesota to be part of our program. This program is called the Manufacturer Responsibility Model. That means that we collect the materials, and then the manufacturers are responsible for taking it back and recycling it in whatever fashion they put together. Some of the manufacturers have very aggressive recycling programs, and some join with others to do recycling programs. But our part of it is the collection of it, and then we get it back to the manufacturers. So there is a registration fee that they pay to be able to do business here in the state of Minnesota. And then based on the market share of their sales, they get a number of
pounds or units?
Pounds that they are responsible for recycling. If they don't meet up to that poundage, then they pay a 50 cent a pound fee for the gap. That money that comes in goes out to the counties for them to help set up their programs. If they have existing programs and they charge people to bring in their computers and monitors and such, we're hoping that money can help be used to buy down that end-of-life fee so that maybe the fee is either very small or goes away. And, you know, each county will make that determination. You have the packet of fiscal notes prepared, and then you also just received an updated one from the Pollution Control Agency. In the second engrossment, we changed the original first-year fee to $5,000, and so the updated fiscal note reflects that amount of money, so that's in there. There's a little piece of in here from the Department of Revenue and Administration as well.
Senator Higgins, I think we'll let Mr. Mueller fill in any more details on the fiscal note to help people understand.
Madam Chair, members, usually I try always having completed updated fiscal notes for this committee, but the speed at which this bill and actually other bills have been moving along, what I have handed out is originally the fiscal note as the bill was introduced for Senate File 235. This one is in your packet. That includes the costs for all the agencies involved in this program. So there are a few small costs for, like, admin and revenue that we'll have to work with the other fiscal analysts and other divisions to make sure it's all accounted for somewhere along the way or covered by the funds in this bill. What Senator Higgins has also passed out is an updated fiscal note based on the new fees that they changed in the last committee, especially the first-year fees. So that shows an additional, basically doubling of the first-year amount that will go into the environmental fund. My understanding, this bill will probably go on its own, but for this committee's purposes, I'll continue to track the cost of this program on our spreadsheets under the PCA because it is money that cycles through that agency. But it doesn't won't necessarily appear in our omnibus bill. So just technically, we will continue to track the cost of this program, but the bill will go on its own.
And Senator Higgins, my understanding is it wouldn't affect our targets because it's out of an internal fund and a fee-based fund.
We brought you some spending, but we brought you some income as well.
Okay. So we don't have to spend it.
But they wouldn't be able to do what they're supposed to do.
Oh, you mean that we have to do that?
Oh. Are you sure?
Are there questions from the committee?
Oh.
Do we have to say is appropriated? Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, one of the issues with this bill going by itself is there's not an appropriation of the money to the agency in the bill. There's a directive in the bill that says the legislature shall appropriate money from the account to these entities, but it doesn't say how much, and it doesn't actually accomplish the appropriation. It just says the legislature shall. So for this to pass on, if it was part of our omnibus bill, you could put the language in, then you'd have an appropriation and for PCA, you'd have a rider for this. If you're going to pass it by itself, it should have either you need to have a statutory appropriation of the money or you need to have a direct appropriation that's contained within the bill. Otherwise, the agency would not be able to spend the money that's coming in.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, can we do that can we work with Mr. Knopf and Mr. Mueller and get that prepared for the big finance?
Well, or can
or do
we
need
it
to
now,
do that here?
Carol, or is that too complicated? Greg, I don't know. We can do it.
A statutory appropriation would be easy, but
Well, I think you'll have to talk over the choices here. One is a statutory appropriation, which is a simple matter of language. Mm-hmm. And the other one is
would be a separate section in the bill appropriating the money. But the issue there is how much for what purpose. And as Mr. Mueller mentioned earlier, covering the costs of the Department of Revenue and the Department of Administration out of this is one possibility. And that's information we don't know right now. So.
Are you going to the tax committee and administration? Who covers those? Which committee covers those budgets? State departments?
State departments.
Yeah. Have you already gone to state departments?
No, Madam Chair, we went to state
division.
Government finance, but state and local government, but we didn't do.
But not finance.
No. And it's such a little piece of this bill.
Okay. Well,
is there a way that we can?
We might be able to do it in the full finance committee. We just need to make sure that we have the appropriate information here before you leave, that to know how it will affect our agencies.
So can we do that?
I don't know.
Madam Chair, as long as all of the money that's going to be appropriated is raised in the bill, it won't affect any of your targets or any of your other financing. So the appropriation section was just appropriating money that's raised here and it's self-contained, it wouldn't affect your targets at all.
It's really just language we have to add just to make it legal.
Okay. And would we add that to this bill, Madam Chair, or would you put that in your omnibus bill?
Well, I think you're saying that we need to add it to the bill.
To this bill.
Madam Chair, I think it should be in the bill because if this bill didn't pass and that one did, it would be best to have it all in one place.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do we accomplish that?
Well, I think, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Knopf.
Senator Higgins, I think it's as you stated earlier, probably getting something ready for the full finance committee would be the best. Because to put something together now, I don't know that we have all the pieces and how much it would be for the administration, how much for the grants. I mean, we kind of know that, but it might be difficult to cobble together in short order and during committee today.
Okay, Madam Chair, we'll work with the brain trust at the table here to make sure that we get that put together.
Sounds good to
finance.
Me. And we'll see you again in finance.
Yes.
All right. I know Ms. Cook wants to testify, so we'll bring her up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates, representing Hewlett Packard today.
Hewlett-Packard has a longstanding commitment to collection and recycling of used electronics and soon will reach 1 billion pounds recycled. As a leader in recycling of used electronics, Hewlett-Packard is on record supporting manufacturer responsibility legislation. We strongly supported Senator Higgins' bill in 2005. Unfortunately, we cannot support this bill because of the method in the bill, which is determined which determines the manufacturer's responsibility, which is a market share approach. Hewlett-Packard supports a return share approach, and I think we visited with all of you about that. For purposes of today's discussion, I think it would be helpful for the committee members to understand the real fiscal impact of this legislation, and I'd like to focus on the variable fee that is in the bill. And what it is basically is a penalty that is paid by manufacturers if they do not meet the required ratio in the bill, which currently for the first year is set at 0.8 pounds of e-waste for every 1 pound sold. So this is going to raise significant revenue beyond what is needed for this program, to run the program, or for the grants. At the 0.8 to 1 ratio, the bill will result in a significant windfall of millions of dollars for the state. Using information that was supplied by the PCA last week, in 2004, approximately 38,814,870 pounds of covered electronics were sold in Minnesota in 2004. The 2008 expected collection of covered electronics is 23,230,075 pounds. That's assuming a rate of 3.42 pounds per capita, which is the Hennepin County number, which far exceeds, for example, what they're getting in California, which has a program that is extensively promoted. Anyways, the result of all that is about a 15.5 million pound difference, which at 50 cents per pound results in a penalty of somewhere in the neighborhood of $7-8 million. This is after manufacturers have already spent in the neighborhood of $9 million to collect every ounce of e-waste that is out there. So I think it is important for this committee to understand that this bill really does generate an awful lot of revenue just simply on the basis of the formula that is in there. And I have heard a lot about the weight of the product and how that's changing. The point is, let's see some real numbers as we look at this ratio, because the way it is now, while weights of some products may be going down, the sales of all of these products are going up and significantly increasing. And so other sizes of other products are increasing. And so based on the information we have today, you are looking at a significant windfall. And I don't need to tell this committee that if history is any indicator, when you have that kind of money appropriate that goes into the general fund, or you know, goes into a fund, the legislature certainly does not necessarily appropriate all of that back to the PCA, despite what this committee might want. Another finance-related issue is the grant program that's established in the bill. The stated intention of this program is to assist e-waste collection and recycling in rural communities. This grant program actually guarantees that manufacturers will fail. In the bill, the money that the legislature appropriates from the e-waste fund is used for grants to private entities and counties outside the 11-county metro area. That means that others, including private entities, are going to get money, funds out of the penalty money that the manufacturers have paid, and then they're going to use that to run programs that compete with the manufacturers' programs, thereby making it more difficult for the manufacturers to meet their goals and paying higher fees. So we think that while this may not be the intention, it certainly does have a significant negative impact on manufacturers and their ability to meet the goals, and you're using the penalty money that they paid for someone else to compete against them. So ideally, Hewlett-Packard would encourage you to consider a return share approach to a manufacturer's responsibility bill. This bill relies on estimates of estimates of estimates, and it's based on consumer behavior. We believe this bill is a significant revenue generator well beyond the needs that are required to collect and recycle used electronics. So appreciate your consideration. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I'd like to hear what you've got to say about Ms. Cook's speech about the problems that she has with your bill, and if there's any adjustments that you could make to try to accommodate her.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, to answer part of that, I'd like Mr. Hickel from the PCA to come up and talk to us about some real numbers that he can add to the information for you.
That's fine.
Somewhere in this checkered past of this bill in the last 5 years, we did contemplate doing the return share model. And then you may remember last year, I think you were even part of the task force that got together to try to figure out what to do with this bill and actually make it happen. And at that point, after hearing more and more and more about the return share, we realized all the problems there were with that particular model. And we then went to the market share. We've given in this bill the manufacturers two ways that they can report that market share. They can do it by actual poundage or units that they sell in the state of Minnesota, or they can extrapolate the information from their nationwide sales, because they continue to tell us they can't tell us how much they sell in the state of Minnesota. So in one of the last committees we were in, we put in that second option that they could extrapolate the information from the information they tell us they do have. And Mr. Hickel's here from the PCA, and I would really like him to be able to talk to you a little bit about the per capita return numbers in California and Maine. I guess I just fundamentally reject the idea that there isn't enough product out there to be recycled, and that the manufacturers won't meet their goals. I know the pile that I've got in my house needs to go somewhere. My husband says we can't get rid of it until we get the bill passed. So at that point, I'll stop babbling and turn it over to Mr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Garth Hickel with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Can you spell your last name, please?
Sure. It's H-I-C-K-L-E.
Okay, thank you.
To answer the question directly regarding the collection rates in the two other states that do have programs that are up and running, California, our latest communication from the California Integrated Waste Management Board was that their collection per capita collection rate for 2006 was 3.64 pounds per person. That does include some commercial waste. Their program is open to both households and commercial entities. In Maine, the collection rate in 2006 was 0.298 pounds per capita. That is, however, with the disposal ban only being in place for 6 months of that time. So we would expect to see the collection rate be much higher in both Maine and California for 2007.
Okay. Does that answer your questions a little bit, Senator Dill?
I'm not sure I totally understand it, but I'm trying to understand it, and it's helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. All right, thank you. I think we have the amendment ready. If there's no questions for Mr. Hickel, sorry.
The funding thing.
Yes, Senator Higgins? I think we have the amendment ready.
Okay.
So we'll go ahead with that.
All right.
Great. Mr. Knopf, can you read?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, it looks like you're going to be able to leave with a statutory appropriation. So what it would be is on page 7, line 10, delete the legislature shall appropriate, delete from and insert in, and before the colon insert is annually appropriated to the Pollution Control Agency. On line 7.11, delete everything, delete to the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency and the commissioner of, basically delete everything after the one paren, and then delete revenue on 7.12, and then before the semicolon, insert, comma, including transfer to the Commissioner of Revenue for the Commissioner's duties under Section 115A.320, Subdivision 2. And then on line 7.13, delete to the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. So let me just read it as it would read after the amendment. It would say, paragraph B, money in the account is annually appropriated to the Pollution Control Agency for the purposes of implementing sections 115A.312 to 115A.1330, including transfer to the Commissioner of Revenue for the Commissioner's duties under Section 115A.320, Subdivision 2, and then two would be to be distributed on a competitive basis, and so on.
Okay. Okay, Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, I would move the amendment just read by Mr. Knopf.
All right. Does everyone understand it, Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair and members, just to quickly explain kind of how that what this does is this would be a statutory appropriation in the Environmental Fund, and maybe at the start of this program, this is probably the best way to go because there's not an exact amount of money that we know is coming into that account, so it's hard to appropriate money out of an account before money actually gets into it. So this way, PCA can only spend what actually comes into that account. Mm-hmm. So going to the statutory appropriation, I think at first works best. Down the road, if we find out a lot of more revenue is coming into this account, we may want to switch it over to a regular appropriation. But I think to start this program off, this might be the best way to go. And it covers the cost of the Department of Revenue, whatever they might incur in implementing their portion of this program. On the fiscal note, admin had a small cost on there, but that was just for their role in buying and disposing future computers, and I think we don't have to cover that cost.
All right, great. Does everyone, any questions on the amendment then? All right, Senator Fredrickson moves the amendment as described. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Where does this bill go next?
To finance. Full finance.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 235 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the full finance committee.
Okay. On that motion, is there any further discussion? Is there anyone else here who'd like to be heard on this bill? Mm-hmm. All right. Hearing no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Senator Vickerman.
Well, I remembered that we never gave a statutory appropriation for the money. Well, we can't get in the passage period. That's not good.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for you today with Senate File 379, and it asks for $140,000 in fiscal year 208. $140,000 in fiscal year 2009. Madam Chair and members, Area 2 has been around for several years. I was a chairman of it years ago. But I want to give just a little history. Then I have Ms. Janeski, who is going to kind of walk through the whole thing for you.
Can you pull your microphone a little closer? Ms. Senator Vickerman, pull your microphone just a little closer, please. It's a little noisy in here. Thank you.
Is that better, Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, during the Ventura administration and that period of time, efforts were made to eliminate joint power organizations. And of the 10 that were in existence at that time, only 3 remained to be funded by the state of Minnesota. And although Area 2 is one of the lucky ones to survive cuts, cuts were dramatic. 26% cut from 189 to 140, and then another 25% from 140 to 105. As a total of 45% cut within 2 years. This proven and successful partnership with the state of Minnesota must continue as the restoration needs of the Minnesota River are critical. Floodwater retention in the headwaters here in Area 2 are where the sediments and nutrients need to be retained to prevent further degradation of water quality up downstream. Madam Chair, as I said, I've been involved in this for several years. They do great work out there. That fits in, Madam Chair, with what your main goal this year is to clean up our waters. This helps clean up our waters by slowing down before it gets into the lakes. So, Madam Chair, I have Ms. Neske here, and she will walk you through the program, and then we'll both be here if you have any questions.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Carrie Netsky. I'm the Area 2 Coordinator for Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Coordinator, or excuse me, Minnesota Basin Projects Incorporated. Normally, I bring several of my board members along with me, but due to the blizzards last week, we had many reschedulings, and they're actually having our monthly board meeting today without me. So here I am. I'm happy. I'm representing the board on their behalf, and we are requesting through the Senate file $140,000 per year, which would be an increase of $35,000 a year of what we currently get today. Before you is a short booklet that summarizes the work that we do and basically the history of our 29 years that we've been in existence and serving those southwestern Minnesota counties. Rather than going through it page by page, I'll let you page through it at your leisure, and I'll just kind of hit some of the highlights of what we do. Area 2's approach to flood control over the last 29 years has been to stop the water where it falls and to construct these floodwater retention projects in a stair-step fashion along the Catoctin Prairie. The Catoctin Prairie is more commonly known as the Buffalo Ridge, and you know the Buffalo Ridge from where all the wind turbine generators are being constructed. What some people don't know about that Buffalo Ridge is that it creates elevation differences of up to 80 feet per mile in the Lacaparral River watershed and down to about 50 feet per mile in the Redwood River watershed. So you can about imagine what those waters do when they come barreling down that slope and when it hits that floodplain. The extreme erosive forces do damage beyond some of your beliefs, I'm sure. But it becomes an annual horror for the people who live there and who try to make a living from the land when they have that naturally occurring phenomenon going on. Area 2's proven approach allows for landowner-friendly and voluntary projects to be built to control these erosive forces. And again, as Senator Vickerman said, to keep those sediments and the nutrients on the land where they belong and not in our already impaired water systems. If I could, I would ask you to turn to page 1 of your booklet. It is a sheet called Project Examples, and the very bottom photos illustrate the erosive forces that I'm talking about. They're actually very common in our area of the state. This area has a very long history of flooding dating back to before 1916, when the Corps of Engineers investigated efforts on the Yellow Medicine River to control floodwaters. Area 2 is very different than other parts of the state in that it also suffers from a secondary form of flooding. Not only do our floodwaters flow from southwest to the Minnesota, southwest in a northeasterly direction to the Minnesota River, but they can also have the ability to stair-step themselves down the coteau and actually jump watersheds. The Lacaparral floodwaters can go into the Yellow Medicine into the Redwood into the Cottonwood, all the way down to Mankato. So really our flooding is twofold for our particular area of the state. The reason for my testimony today is to explain our need for increased administrative funding from that current level of $105,000 a year to the $140,000 level. If you turn one more page to page 2 of your booklet, you'll see a graph that illustrates our past funding for the last 10 years. The administrative funding that I'm talking about is in the yellow. The other colored bars are project appropriations that we have received through LCMR and bonding to actually pay for the construction of the floodwater projects that I've spoken about. As Senator Vickerman said, back in 1978, the Area 2 organization was created by statute, and it's been, again, a very proven, successful partnership. At that time, there was an annual appropriation of $250,000 that was made to the organization, not only to fund the small administration part of it, but also to fund the construction. Back in the mid-'80s, that amount was reduced to $189,000, and that remained level up until 2001, which was during the Ventura administration. At that time, there was some efforts made to eliminate joint powers organizations. And again, as Senator Vickerman said, we were a lucky one. We survived, and we were able to restore some funding. The first cut that we took was from $189,000 to $140,000, which was 26%. Then another year, 2 years later, we were supposed to go from 140 down to zero, but we were able to save 105. So again, just within 2 years' time, we took a hit of 45%. We have been able to survive with, of course, constraints of our own budgets. But again, it's getting difficult as our cost of living continue to rise and operating expenses also rise. The 9-member counties, they have a proven commitment to Area 2 as they have been from the beginning. Back when these cuts were taking place, they certainly could have cut their 25% share of the costs accordingly, but they didn't want to do that. So during these cut years, they continued to match the $189,000 amount just as if it never happened. And actually, just the last fiscal year, they did bump it up another 2%. So in contrast to the $105,000 that the state puts in, the 9-member counties are contributing about $85,000. So that's a far cry from the 25% that they were expected to put in. An additional strain to administrative budget is a lack of professional engineering services that were provided by the state at one time. The engineer who was assigned to Area 2 retired 9 years ago in 1998, and due to budget constraints at that time, he was never replaced. Given that fact, we've been hiring consultant engineering through our own administrative budget, which again takes another large chunk of that budget that's been dwindling year by year. Area 2 has successfully proven that it can do more with less, just as we have been asked to do, but we are at a point that after 4 years of minimum funding, that the member counties cannot provide the additional funds that are needed to meet those statutory intent of the Area 2 organization. This long-standing partnership between Area 2 and the state needs to continue just as it was started those 29 years ago. By doing our part to reduce the flooding and to keep those sediments and nutrients here on the land, especially in the headwaters, we are bettering the Minnesota and the Mississippi River for the generations to come. With that, I will cease my comments, and if you have any questions or clarifications I can provide, I'd be happy.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, is it Ms. Netsky?
Netsky.
Do you have any records for the number of acres of wetlands you've restored in your area over the past many years?
Madam Chair and Senator Dill, I don't have those numbers off the top of my hat. I can provide them. With the environmental concerns becoming a large part of permitting and projects, almost every project that we build these days, there deals with some kind of wetland mitigation, and we normally build and provide more mitigation than what is required for replacement.
And you do keep records of that?
Yes, we do.
Well,
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Ms. Netsky, as long as you've offered to provide the information, would you please provide me with the information when you get it or when you get home? Thank you.
Senator Dill, I certainly will.
Me too.
Senator, perhaps you could make it available to the committee and we can distribute it.
I certainly will.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just like to make a comment in very strong support of this program. They do excellent work, and it's going to take a long time, sustained effort to continue to reduce the flooding that comes to the Minnesota River. And certainly the counties involved in this have some benefit from this program, but there are other benefactors too, perhaps larger benefactors of the counties and communities that are downstream from this area too. Counties like Nicollet and cities like St. Peter and Blue Earth County and Le Sueur County and Jordan, because if we can hold this water back, it reduces the flooding, reduces the flood damage further downstream in the Minnesota River. And to understand why this is so important, just a word about the change in elevation from what we refer to as the Buffalo Ridge or the ridge that's west of Marshall to Redwood Falls. There is about as much change in elevation from that point to Redwood Falls as there is from Redwood Falls to the Gulf of Mexico. So when there's a large rain event in western Minnesota, it really comes rushing down this area of the state. So the more of those road retentions we can put in place to hold that water back for a couple of days, the more of those dam impoundments that we can build so that we take that crest off the floodwaters, the less flood damage we'll have to pay downstream.
So I guess it's not just flat prairies all the way to North
Madam
Dakota
Chair,
and South
you know,
Dakota.
That's what's deceiving. You know, if you drive from, let's say, from Fairfax out to South Dakota, you think you're just going across flat prairie. But in fact, you aren't. You're going up an elevation about 1,000 feet.
Wow.
Which,
I didn't realize
Madam Chair, that.
That
might have something to do with why it's a good place to put wind generators,
turbines,
too.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Netsky, on this page about typical road retention projects, I guess I'm fairly impressed with what I see there, and I really wasn't aware that these things were going in, but it sounds like a great idea. How many of these have you put in out there?
Madam Chair and Senator Dill, again, I don't have the exact numbers. I would say that within our 9-member counties, there have got to be at least 50 of them that exist. Lyon County has been at the forefront of this, and I know within Lyon County alone there's 37.
Okay, and then the other question, where you're backing up the water for a couple of days and so forth, is that typically into a pasture area or a meadow where you can cut hay off of it sometimes, or or what kind of ground are you using up?
Madam Chair and Senator Dale, you're correct. Primarily, the retention basins are in ravines, and those are normally pastures or even just waste ground that don't even get hayed. A lot of the slopes are just too steep to do anything with that ground. On a rural, some instances, there might be just a few acres of crop ground at a higher elevation. We do pay flood easements for any loss of crop or anything like that, but otherwise the land stays in the landowner's name. He continues to pay taxes on it just as before.
Ms. Netsky, I assume there were probably pre-settlement a lot more wetlands in the area. Maybe that would have helped with the flooding if we had preserved more of those. I mean, obviously hindsight is 20/20.
Madam Chair, I believe you are correct. Wetlands aren't my area of expertise, but yes, when you see the flooding that happens out there, it is those depressed areas that fill, of course, and they do tend to meter out the waters as intended, but unfortunately they're covered in crops now instead of the wetland vegetation as before. But from all the research that I'm aware of, that yes, that wetlands and increased wetlands would help the flooding situation.
Okay, Senator Vickerman, if there's no further discussion, would you like to move your bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 379 be recommended passed for possible inclusions in our big budget bill. Is that the right?
Our really medium-sized budget bill, yeah. Yes.
I would like to say it will be included, but I'll be with everybody else for possible inclusion.
All right, thank you. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, Senator Olsen is here. Okay.
Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment.
I think it's coming.
And should I talk to the bill while it's being
sure,
passed out?
Sure, go ahead and start.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. This bill kind of has grown out of my being on the Energy Committee, and I was touring the high school in Rush City, and I was in the boiler room, and I noticed there was no boiler in the boiler room. So they have a geothermal heat pump system in their high school where they circulate 25,000 gallons of water that circulates underneath the fields outside the school, and so they heat that building with a series of air exchangers located throughout the building that raise the temperature from the temperature of the water to the whatever room temperature they need. So they also are able to cool the building the same way. So I guess I would like to move the author's amendment.
Okay, Senator Olsen, because this bill has already come through another committee, then you need to actually explain the difference between the amendments so the committee can choose whether to accept it.
Okay, thank you. The funding for this, we're limiting it to $50,000. And in the original bill, the money was going to come from the reliability administrator in the Public Utilities Commission. But that money, I believe, is sunsetted, so that it's no longer available. So in the new bill, the funding will be appropriated from the funds assessed by the Public Utilities Committees under the statute listed there. That's the primary difference.
Oh, okay. So the actual study is the same as it was?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, well, that's any other questions about the amendment? Would a member like to move? Senator Chaudhry moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I like you guys.
Wait. We didn't pass the bill yet.
Sorry.
Yeah. That was just the amendment. You'll still like us,
okay.
I'm sure. But are there any questions about the bill, Senate File 474? All right. Senator Chaudhry moves that, is that all right, Senator Chaudhry, that Senate File 474 as amended be recommended for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So because it's requesting funding, we'll have to keep it here and try to fit it into our omnibus funding bill. Is that
I still like you, Madam Chair.
On that motion, if there's no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
We like you too. I think I'm next. Oh, we lost our vice chair. Senator Dill, I think you're first. You're on first. Would you like to chair for me, please? Would you kind of hold on to this? I don't want to take it.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a request for an additional appropriation for low-income heating assistance. We heard a lot about this issue last year when natural gas prices were spiking way high and out of control, and we were very, very worried. A lot of people across our state and country were very worried about how they were going to continue to pay their heating bills. We did give this issue a lot of attention last year. It's not so visible this year because it hasn't been as cold of a winter, and so it hasn't been in the news, but the fact is there are still thousands of Minnesotans who are unable to fully pay their heating bills to get through the winter. And even though it's maybe 20 degrees instead of 20 below, you still have to have the heat on. And so it's an ongoing problem, unfortunately, that we haven't had sufficient attention to. And the federal government has traditionally funded this program, but they've also been cutting their allocations in recent years. So that adds to the burden for some of our families across Minnesota. And this is a problem that affects people all across the state. So I won't say more. I will let my witnesses really explain to you the details of why this is so important, but I'll introduce them. On my left, I have Pam Marshall from the Energy Sense Coalition. On my right, Catherine Fair, who's the Director of Energy Assistance from the CAP agencies, the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. And I have, I believe, two more people who probably want to testify, so we'll try to keep it each one brief.
Who do you want to have testify first?
It's Marshall, please.
Pam Marshall, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pam Marshall, I have directed the Low-Income Energy Advocacy Organization, the Energy Sense Coalition, since 1992. Discussions about the Energy Assistance Program raise a lot of issues, but I'm going to try to focus today on just a few basic facts. First, without a federal contingency allocation or a state appropriation, this year's energy assistance program will experience a $47 million cut over last year's funding level. There's also no guarantee, of course, that any federal contingency funds will be released, and even if they are, the amount to Minnesota is uncertain. Second, while heating prices were higher last year, actually heating costs are higher this year, even before the recent cold snap caused increased heating fuel consumption. And even though fuel prices are lower this year than they were last year, they are still 24 to 43% higher than they were just 4 years ago. Third, the state expects to run out of energy assistance funds before April 15th, exactly the time when those funds are needed to help low-income customers who are behind on their energy bills to avoid service disconnections. And there will be service disconnections. As of January this year, nearly 183,000 CenterPoint customers were past due. That's 50,000 more customers than received energy assistance statewide last year, even under the higher funding level. Xcel experienced a 30% increase in low-income customer arrears from October 2005 to October 2006. In other words, people entered the heating season behind on their bills. They experienced even higher bills this year, and at the same time, the average energy assistance grant was cut. The state reports that the same number of households have applied for energy assistance this year as did last year, but given the funding cut, as many as 15,000 to 20,000 fewer households can expect to receive assistance at all. Fourth, there will be no money to open the program in the fall. That means that there is no money to help customers who are behind going into the next heating season or to reconnect those who are disconnected going into that heating season altogether. Mr. Chair and members, we understand the significance of the energy issues that you've addressed this session, and we support the work that you've done to sustain Minnesota's energy future. Obviously, environmental concerns should inform our energy policies. Today, we're asking that our energy policy also address the inability of one quarter of our state's population to maintain energy service at all. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Could I just ask a quick question here? Now, with the governor's proposed budget, are you, with your bill here, are you enhancing what he is doing, or isn't he doing anything?
Mr. Chair and members, last year there was a $13.4 million state supplement to the $111 million in federal money that Minnesota received. It's my understanding that there is no state supplementary money in the governor's budget this year.
Okay, thank you.
There's none. There never is. Yeah. No,
okay.
That's right.
So, Catherine Fair, are you next?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Catherine Fair. I'm the Director of Energy Assistance at Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. Our program service area includes over 12% of the energy assistance eligible households in the state. I've heard this committee has a very full schedule this afternoon, so I won't be able to say everything I'd like to, but I brought the committee's a copy of a DVD entitled Helping with Heat that was completed recently to provide information to the community about energy assistance. It was produced in partnership with the local television station St. Paul Neighborhood Network, and the short 15-minute program includes interviews of six energy assistance participants talking about the impact of the program in their lives. Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties is the largest provider of energy assistance in Minnesota. Thank you. Serving almost 17,000 out of the estimated 50,000 eligible households in Ramsey and Washington Counties. Although the income limit for this program is 50% or less of the state median income, or under $33,000 a year for a family of three, the average income for our families is only $15,000 per year. This is under the federal poverty line of $16,600 for a family of three. Last year, due to high natural gas prices, the federal and state supplement funding, and the media attention that Senator Anderson talked about, the low-income home energy assistance program experienced the highest number ever of applications received and grants awarded. This year, at my agency, we have even more applications this year than we did at the same time last year, and the statewide pace for applications is identical to last year. At the current rate that we're processing grants, both in our office and statewide, the Department of Commerce is projecting that the current energy assistance funds will run out before April 15th. So I just want to reiterate what Pam Marshall had said, and what it means for my agency is that I'm expecting to face over 3,500 households that received assistance last year that I cannot help this year, and well over 2,000 households that need crisis grants to avert disconnections will be turned away. Low-income people in Minnesota are going to need additional financial help from the state. First, to ensure low-income households in Minnesota are not left out in the cold come April when we're out of funds. And lastly, I'd like to quote Senator Norm Coleman from this same time last year. He said, I'm fighting to ensure Minnesotans never have to make the impossible choice of heating their homes or putting food on the table. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Senator Anderson, should we complete the testimony first and then ask for questions?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, the next person I have on the list then is Ron Elwood. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. We've been working with low-income customers for, I don't know how many years, 40, 50 years, 100 years, I don't know. But we provide free legal assistance to low-income Minnesotans statewide. What I'd like to remind you of is that by providing some energy assistance, no matter how much you can find in your budget, and we all know that money is tight this year, but the extent to which you can find some funds in the committee to appropriate for this cause, you will be helping families to become more secure, and not just more energy secure, because disconnections have a ripple effect. Not only do people lose their heat or electricity, but students do poorly in school because they're not stable. People wind up displaced. It increases homelessness. There are all sorts of social consequences that are attached to utility disconnections. You're not going to solve everybody's problems, but the more you can provide under this bill, the more folks and the more citizens and the more constituents you can move to total stability and security. So anything you can do, we would be we'd greatly appreciate.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Elwood. I have Keith Weigel next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Keith Weigel. I'm the advocacy director with AERP Minnesota, and we're very supportive of this bill and Senator Rosen's bill about to come up. And I would just say that AERP works very hard at the national level to get maximum funding. Last year, we were supportive of the fact that the governor did find an additional $13 million. And our organization feels strongly about it that even those that were participating were really only reaching 30% of those that are eligible for it. And we made an effort both last year and at the beginning of this heating system to contact a number of our members that we think could benefit from it. And our position would be that anything that you could add to the heating assistance program would be put to good use. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weigel. Does the committee have any questions for the witnesses? Senator Immel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which mic I have? I think I heard you correctly. Did you say that there are 25% of the population are unable to meet their heating needs?
Mr. Chair and Senator, 25% of Minnesota's population is income eligible for the program because we operate the program at 50% of state median income. It's also important, though, as Ms. Fair was pointing out about her agency, that while those income guidelines are relatively high as far as means-tested programs goes, 52% of Minnesota's energy assistance households actually live at 100% of the federal poverty level and below, so at an average income of about $8,900 a year for half of the energy assistance population and about $16,000-something a year for the average for all of the 133,000 that received it last year.
I wasn't questioning your number. I just find it startling. My question is, are there other factors that are contributing to the increase in numbers of people applying for the assistance other than the increased cost in energy?
No, Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that is why people are applying. They can't sustain it on their own anymore, and they start to look for any resource that is available. And I think that and some of the outreach efforts like AARP's have increased the population over last year, but typically the funding level drives some of those outreach efforts and the prices drive the funding level, and then we end up with more households each year.
Mr. Chair, what I'm asking basically is, people's incomes are not keeping track with the, it's not just the cost of energy, it is also the cost. Is that a correct assumption, that income levels are not keeping track with the inflationary costs of energy and other things that are impacting people's lives?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, that's absolutely true. On the lower end of the income scales, incomes are not keeping up with the higher cost of living. And, you know, seniors in particular, we all hear every day about the cost of health care. And so not only do people have to choose between heat and food, they have to choose between heat and medicine that they need to survive and other essential costs, the price of gasoline.
Housing.
I mean, we all know these things are going up. And when the necessities of life go up beyond your income, there's no cushion there because those are all essentials of life.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Marshall, would you repeat the two statistics that you gave us? One, I believe, was 25% of Minnesotans are eligible. And the other, the one I didn't fully hear was the 52% of...
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, yet 25% of Minnesota's population is income eligible at the guidelines under which the state administers the energy assistance program. Out of the 133,000 households that received help last year, over half, that was the 52% number, lived on incomes at or below 100% of the federal poverty level, a significantly lower threshold than the income eligibility guidelines.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Marshall, so it's 52% of the 133,000.
Correct.
That makes more sense to me.
So, Mr. Chair and members, you know, as has been stated, the federal funding for this program has been cut the last several years, and we're relying on those federal dollars for the program. So the state has tried to supplement this program in years when there's a dire need. And we just want to convey that the need is just as dire as it was last year. And we were able to supplement the funding last year with $13 million. It's a very good use of one-time money if that's all that we can provide. Obviously, that amount of money will be very, very difficult. But if we can do anything in this committee to help, it would mean a lot to a lot of people in our state. So, Mr. Chair, should I move the bill?
Senator Anderson, I think we'll just ask first, is there anybody else here that wants to testify on the bill? If not, why don't you make the appropriate motion?
Right. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1280 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
You've all heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.
Is Senator Rosen here?
She's checked in a couple of times, and she's been she left her cell phone.
Yes.
Oh. Oh. Even his youth may be a little bit.
Yeah, he's having a guy.
Well, we still got time. And I don't know where Sparks. I assume Sparks is in the committee.
Wow.
Thank you, Senator Dill. She's on her way?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We will. Senator Rosen's on her way, so we'll be taking up her bill shortly. Bring Deputy Commissioner Garvey up for 1 minute. Yeah. Yeah, as long as you're here, you can get us ready. because I'm just looking at the bill and trying to remember. Last year, this bill, the propane pre-purchase bill, is something that we worked on last session with Senator Metzen, Senator Rosen, myself, and Deputy Commissioner Garvey from Commerce. I hate to do this before Julie gets here, but just to, maybe you could give us just a little bit of background. Here she is. No, it's okay. Don't leave. Don't leave.
Almost escaped.
I just want maybe while you're catching your breath, Senator Rosen, just remind us where now I think the department agreed to go ahead with. Oh, maybe we should let Senator Rosen talk so she can explain it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Back to the committee.
It's very nice to be back, Madam Chair and members. I miss this committee. I really do. But Senate File 1068 has a little history to it. And if you remember last year, Senator Metzen and myself worked on this pre-purchase agreement through the Department of Commerce for delivered fuel. And it passed, and they received a large amount of money last year, $28 million, and they took $4 million of that to do pre-purchase, which they had been doing for the last 11, 12 years, and then they stopped. But we won't talk about that. But so we decided that in order to save money, we would start this and do this again. Unfortunately, there was some good parts about last summer's buying and some bad parts. So basically, this bill this year is to appropriate some money out of the general fund to pre-purchase again. And I will have Pam Marshall from Energy Sense come up and talk about perhaps some of the logistics of that. But it's a good program. It just had a few problems this last summer. And I'll let Mr. Garvey talk more about that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Do you want to start with Ms. Marshall or Mr. Garvey?
Madam Chair, the bill did not pass.
Yeah.
The Department of Commerce went ahead. That's right.
It did not pass. It was
Thank you.
Of the bills caught at the end of session that died.
That's right. But they went ahead and did it because they knew it was a good plan.
Yes, that's right. They agreed to do it voluntarily. So, Mr. Garvey, do you want to just sort of fill us in on what happened?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. And in this role, I do oversee the implementation of the state's low-income heating energy assistance program, a program that you just heard a little bit about with the chair's bill just moments ago. The pre-buy program is a very simple concept. You would buy propane at a time when it's cheaper, generally in the summertime, and then have it used for the following winter. The conundrum that we face at the Department of Commerce is that that requires the department to sort of set aside money, for example, now, for use this summer for next winter. The money that we have now would otherwise be spent on households that are in need of paying their bills today. Over the past years, we have chosen not to set aside the dollars because we would meet the current need, and therefore we wouldn't have money in the summer to pre-buy. We were able to do that both because we understood the wise policy direction that the legislature was sending to us, but also we were able to get a large emergency grant from the federal government at the very end of last year's winter season. This past March, a year ago, that we were able to sort of set aside dollars from. We don't have that luxury this year. I can go into the actual details of the pre-buy program if the committee wishes, but the bill itself, as I understand Senator Rosen's intent, is to give the department funds specifically for the pre-buy for the summer's pre-buy purchase for the following winter.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This testimony is a lot like the previous testimony. No surprise, we need money to be able to purchase a propane when those prices are lower and lock in. Just to let you know, of those 133,000 households that were able to receive assistance last year, about 19% of them heat with propane, so it's a significant number of households. With no consumer protections against winter service disconnections, these households are the most vulnerable to fuel price increases and to cuts in the energy assistance program. While much of the price increase attention is focused on natural gas over the last couple of years, propane costs actually increased more this year than natural gas did, a 32% increase from last year on top of already historically high prices. Natural gas was up about 25%. Propane was up 32%. 5 years ago, a LIHEAP grant helped low-income households to purchase about 38% of the fuel necessary for seeing them through the winter. Now that same grant purchases about 26%. So obviously, any savings we can get by buying in bulk, buying early, those sorts of things are important for these households. Again, the idea with propane is we buy in bulk, we lock in at the lowest possible price. Households that receive energy assistance grants can purchase more fuel because they're doing so at less than the current retail. I personally heat with propane. I locked in at $179. The going price now is $199, and those swings have historically been even more pronounced from summer to winter. By our estimation, we could have saved energy assistance program about $4 million over the last several years if we had done this each year. The appropriation in Senator Rosen's bill would bolster the effectiveness of the energy assistance grants by ensuring that those households can purchase more with the same grant level, and that's why we're urging you to pass this bill.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen suggests I give a little more background on the low-income heating program itself and in the context in which pre-buy fits in. Each year, each fall, depending upon the federal government's budgetary process, the state of Minnesota gets a large lump sum of dollars that we then, starting in October into November, we give to households in need. This year, consistent with the most recent past years, we received a lump sum of about $70 million. Combined with pre-buy, combined with other things that we were able to hold over from last session, the last year, and a most recent final allocation of the state's allocation, we received about $7.9 million just last week as a final allocation to a total of $77 million in cash from the federal government, roll in pre-buy, roll in the other things. We will have allocated about $90 million in low-income heating for this winter heating season. As Ms. Marshall testified on the previous bill, there are approximately 400,000 households, roughly a quarter of the population of the state of Minnesota, that's eligible for low-income heating assistance. Of those 400,000 households, we expect to serve about 115,000, a little less than a third, which is consistent with our historic pattern. Each household receives, and it varies by household size and income, so it's a very complex matrix, will receive on average a $500 assistance, which is roughly a third of their total energy heating bills. So we never have enough money to serve the entire population, and that the entire population that we serve, we only serve portion of that. The pre-buy program is an opportunity where we may be able to spread those dollars over more heating units and over more households.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dale.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, Senator Rosen, maybe you said this, and maybe I missed it, but how reliable is it that you can buy propane cheaper in the summer than in the winter? Is that always the case?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Dill. I am not an expert at propane buying. It is my understanding that has been historic pattern. It has also been our observation as we look at fuels in other contexts that we're seeing increasing volatility of fuels, heating fuels in general, and propane is no exception to that. As Senator Rosen's introductory comments indicated, that was actually one of the questions that we had to sort of struggle with this past pre-buy purchasing period was when to buy, how much to buy, and what's the market doing. And those are complicated questions that always need to be sort of dealt with, and you're always subject to second guessing after the as you make those decisions.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I found that over the years it's always good to buy low and sell high.
Maybe we should put that into the law.
Whether that's cheap or propane.
Well, what I found when a corn is really high or cattle are really high, even if it's at the wrong time of year, it's dangerous to buy thinking that it's going to go higher. And, of course, it could. But there's added risk when you're already at a high level buying, thinking it's going to go higher. If it's at a low level, historically low level, it's a lot safer to buy because there's much more up potential just in the normal trading range. So the only point I'm making is that you get into a situation where you've got very high propane prices in the dead of summer heat, and you think you're going to buy to save money next winter, it may not work out that way because the potential for going higher is probably not as much as the potential for going down because of the normal trading range.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dill, that you make a very valid point. Historically, it has been lower in the summers to buy the heat, and they have done that, and I should correct myself. I thought it was for a longer period of time they've been doing this, but I was corrected by Ms. Marshall that it's only been 5 years that they had been buying in the summer and saving money, being able to spread out their monies with more fuel to more customers. We just didn't work out this way this year. And then with the very cold snap, hard cold snap this winter, the intent is to make this work. And
Senator Dill?
Well, Madam Chair, members, I think it's a good idea, but I think a person should, if you can get the money, make it available, but then wait and see what happens. Let's not decide right now if we're going to buy propane in the summer. Let's see how low it gets. And if it doesn't really get down much in the lower part of the normal trading range, it seems a little risky to stick a lot of money into it.
Ms. Marshall?
Madam Chair and Senator, that's exactly a few responses to the issue that you raised. One, and this may be where the dozen or so years came from, the state, I think, has tracked propane prices since 1993, and I think with 1 year's exception between then and now, the summer price after crop drying season was always lower. However, up until the last 6 or 7 heating seasons, propane was also in the 70 to 90 cent a gallon range, and now, you know, the summer price is $1.79, so it's very difficult to squeeze out savings. I do think, though, that there are other ways in which having this resource available can save money. First of all, only buying a portion of the aggregate number of gallons of fuel that are used by the population of energy assistance households that heat with propane, so that you're not locking in all of those gallons. You're essentially hedging by buying less than 100%, significantly less, a third to half of what they would use. And the other thing is, I think negotiating with vendors instead of just at the local distribution level, but, you know, at the headquarters for Ferrell and AmeriGas and companies like that, so that you get the best possible price because you are buying that many more bulk gallons. And so, and to ask those vendors what they're seeing in terms of the trend. You know, it is July 1. What does it look like August 15th? And in our experience, when we actually administered the pre-buy at Energy Sense, vendors were more than willing to have that conversation with us. They would say, in fact, we're holding off buying ourselves because we're waiting until we think the price is going in this direction, and that's what we did. So there are ways to hedge against that. It is harder to get savings when you're already starting at that higher price. And the other thing is there's a lot of variation on a per-gallon basis out there. I think the high for last year's program was as much as $2.20 a gallon, and the low was about $1.45. And to me, that's a very interesting question, why that product is that much more in some areas. But that's another story.
And I think we allow the commissioner to have discretion under this. I mean, this is not the language of the bill that right. we had last year. This just gives the money. And so there's an ability to make that decision, correct? I mean, is that the way you see it, Mr. Garvey, that you have the power to decide if it's a good deal or not? Yeah, we're putting it all on you. You get the risk. I understand there is some risk involved, but the benefit can be very, very great. And so that's why we're asking the department to take that, you know, using the knowledge that they have to do the best that they can.
That's right.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Senator Rosen. We have some other out-of-town witnesses, so we do need to move on. So, Mr. Garvey, I won't make you answer that. It was more of a rhetorical question anyway. I think any other comments?
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that this is for the low-income, fixed-income people, and this is why it was brought to our attention last year. The program's great. Mm-hmm. And I hope you'll consider
Thank you, Senator
this.
Rosa.
Thank you.
I think it's a great idea, too. I was a big supporter of this last year. It's just matter of money, which everything else is. So what we would do is lay the bill over if someone would make that motion for the committee. Senator Rummel, would you like to move it?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Senator Rummel moves that Senate File 1068 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Great. Thank you very much. And Senator Rosen, on your other bill, I think you have someone from...
I do, Madam Chair.
...out of town, and then Senator Sparks, I believe there's some out-of-town people here as well, and we want to make sure we get at least get their testimony in case we run out of time. So I'm going to have Senator Sparks. Thank you, Chair.
This one, so we're down.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're not here to film. Me? Go ahead, sit down, please.
Again, Senate File 530, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment. Basically, Mr. Chair, what this does is just puts the language of the bill in better perspective for the DNR. Just a little different rewording, nothing significant.
Senator Fredrickson, you move the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I will.
Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
It's ready for you.
Today I have with me Mr. Al Forsberg. He's the Blue Earth County engineer. And this bill deals with a study that's required for the Rapidan Dam. And I love this dam. It's a beautiful dam. But basically, this study is, you guys are supposed to laugh because it is, I mean, it's a beautiful, it's a Rapidan Dam. It's the study is going to focus on the geotechnical and the hydraulic portion of the foundation. It's a very old dam, and it's, we need to figure out what we're going to do with the dam. So this bill was basically in front of this committee last year, and It passed, but it didn't. We didn't get to do anything with the bill. So, also, this $60,000 or the study that we're asking would also put us in line for federal assistance, and that's really important. The total cost of the study is $199,000. The federal share would be $79,000. The county share is $60,000. And the state share would be $60,000. So the bill basically says we're just taking 50% of the non-federal cost. So we do have something that we're passing out, Mr. Chair, members. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Forsberg.
Mr. Forsberg, would you identify yourself and go ahead?
Alan Forsberg, the county engineer for Blue Earth County in Mankato, Minnesota, and the person responsible for this beautiful dam.
Thank you.
Just a little general information on the dam. Rapidan Dam is located about 12 miles south of Mankato. It's a hollow, reinforced concrete, Amberson-type dam founded on sandstone in a steep, U-shaped, very beautiful valley of the Blue Earth River. The reservoir is filled with about 12 million cubic yards of sediment, slightly contaminated with agricultural chemicals accumulated over the years. The dam was constructed in 1910 by a private company for hydroelectric generation. In 1965, the Tater Gates were destroyed by flooding and the electrical equipment was taken out. In the mid-80s, a private developer put in new gates and new electrical equipment, and it does generate about 5 megawatts of renewable energy, which is sufficient to support a city of about 2,000 people. The dam and the reservoir is owned by Blue Earth County. It was given to us by Northern States Power when they abandoned the site. The electrical generating equipment is owned and operated by North American Hydro, a private business. Condition of the dam, it is an old dam, and it does have some problems. In 2002, emergency repairs to the foundation of the dam were made when we found that much of the foundation had scoured away, eroded away. In the fall of 2003, we found the concrete apron below the spillway was damaged, and we made repairs to that. We're currently repairing the bridge deck on top of the dam so that it's safe for access for those who have to use it. The county has been trying to take a long-term look at the dam for a number of years now. In 1997, we did a study evaluating alternatives for the future of the dam at a limited level of detail. In 2000, we did a very detailed study on the feasibility of removing the dam. The next year, we did a detailed feasibility study of repairing the dam and leaving it in place. Recently, the Army Corps of Engineers did a lower Minnesota River Basin reconnaissance study. One of the problems / opportunities they looked at was the Rapidan Dam. And in that study, they found it would cost about $8 to $10 million to repair the dam, $20 to $30 million to remove the dam. They also recommended that a detailed feasibility study be done to better understand and to provide better information. The dam does have significant economic and renewable energy considerations, but also historic, recreation, and environmental implications. So that brings us to the point where the Federal Corps of Engineers and the DNR, Division of Waters, and the county would all like to proceed with this detailed core feasibility study, which would look at the economic, social, and environmental feasibility of doing nothing, which clearly is not acceptable, rehabbing the dam, or removing the dam. The first stage of that study would look at the hydraulics, the spillway, the design flood, how much water is coming at the dam, is it safe for that amount of water, and it would also look at the geotechnical aspects, primarily the foundation. We need to understand the sandstone foundation underneath it, and is it stable? And with that foundation, is it even feasible to think about leaving the dam in place and renewing it? So that's what we're here to propose today, is a partnership, really, between the federal government and the county and the state, where for this first stage of study, the federal government has set aside in a water appropriations bill $79,000, which is available. The county board has indicated that it would provide $60,000 if the state can partner with $60,000.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg. Questions of the committee? Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how long you've been trying to do this project? Seems like I visited as a member of the Capital Investment Committee about 9 years ago. Would that be the same one?
This would be the same dam, although beautiful. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator. This would be the same dam, although beautiful. It has been a bit of a juvenile delinquent. And we have been doing these studies to try to identify what's the best path to take, and then we've had to do these emergency repairs to keep it in a stable condition while we try to come up with resources for a long-term solution.
Well, it seemed like it had a lot of memorable characteristics here, Mr. Chair, so I just thought, you know, it has to be the same one, same town, same county, you know. Thank you.
It's a duck test, Senator Cooley. If it looks like it.
Yeah.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Forsberg, so you're hoping that Senator Rosen has better luck with this juvenile delinquent than Senator Hottinger did. Because I, too, have heard a lot about this dam. I think I've been a co-author on many of the bills that have occurred. But seriously, is this a safety concern? Is it a functional concern, aesthetic concern, or is there a safety element to this request?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Mr. Forsberg.
It is all of those things, but the primary concern is the safety aspect and doing the right thing for the long-term future out there. If the dam were to fail, and it came close to it, actually, when we had to do that foundation repair, you would have 12 million cubic yards of muck that is not stable, that would be flowing downstream, would have significant environmental impacts. Some of it would deposit in the Mankato Flood Control Channel. Our county highway bridge upstream of the dam would lose its foundation support. So it does have very significant implications to solving this problem.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, and Mr. Forsberg, I think my wife's or my father-in-law's company, Johnson Brothers Corporation out of Litchfield, did some repair work on this bridge more than once over the last several decades. My father-in-law wrote a history book about Johnson Brothers Corporation. I think there's a section in there about this dam, mm-hmm. some of the work they did on it. I note down here that there's the generating equipment is owned and operated by the North American Hydro. What town is that company located in?
Mr. Chair, Senator, they're out of Wisconsin. The majority ownership has recently changed from Rapidan Hydropower and Canlever and Actian Development to North American Hydro.
Okay. Well, I think we should go ahead and try one more time to do this study. I agree with Senator Cooley. It's been around for a long time, and maybe the problem was we needed a woman in charge, and Senator Rosen. To get the job done finally.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Dill.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate that. But in all seriousness, I mean, the dam is 97 years old, and this detailed feasibility study is extremely important for more federal assistance, too. So with that, I would appreciate your support.
All right. Thank you, Senator Rosen. Is there anybody else from the public who would like to comment on the dam? Any other comments from the committee? Not Senator Dill, were you going to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we lay this bill on the table for possible consideration to be put into the omnibus funding bill for the environment.
Motion by Senator Dill. Any discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Lay it over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg. Senate File 642, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, to present Senate File 642. I know that time is running short. This is a bill that was heard in Environment and Policy a few days ago. It deals with ditch buffer strips and drainage system requirements. It reflects the recommendation of the drainage work group that was established by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. With that, I think we're here to basically talk about the funding proposal. You should have a handout, and to walk you through that quickly is Mr. Doug Thomas, the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you, Senator. Go ahead, Mr. Thomas. Identify yourself, please, and go ahead and enter testimony.
Mr. Chair, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And the handout that Senator Sparks is referring to that you should have in your packet looks like that. As Senator Sparks said, this bill was 2 years in the making. The policy provisions of the bill, which relate to public drainage system buffers, was presented and passed out of the Environment Policy Committee last week, moved to the Senate Ag Committee. Basically, on the appropriation side of it, the bill that you have in front of you, if you look at the column that says House File 577, Senate File 642, it includes $150,000 in the first year of the biennium for developing guidelines for the preservation and modernization of public drainage system records. In the second year of the biennium, it provides $2 million, or again, also in the first year of the biennium, $2 million for cost-share grants. Those would be matching grants that would be available to public drainage authorities to offset some of the cost of preserving and modernizing some of those very antiquated ditch records. Then there was $300,000 for the Minnesota Public Drainage Manual update in 2008 and an unspecified amount for drainage work group facilitation. That would be the continuation of the work group that was established, and it would be a work group that would continue to meet and function to take up and debate additional topics relating to our state's public drainage systems. And then the creation of a drainage assistance team, which was an unspecified amount. The governor's recommendation, which is in the right-hand column, includes, which is in the Bowser budget, which we overviewed with this committee last Friday, albeit during the snowstorm, which made it interesting. $150,000 in the first year of the biennium to develop those drainage record preservation and modernization guidelines. And we look at that $150,000 as being able to get that done in the first year. And then the governor is recommending $500,000 in the second year. Get the record, get the guidelines done in the first year, and then make some grant money available in the second year of the biennium. Look at how it goes, how well or how successful, and what kind of interest is in there, and then come back later on and maybe ask for additional money to complete the records modernization. We did estimate that if we were to cost share at that 50-50 kind of share, it would take about $2 million to finish or to complete that record modernization process in all counties and watershed districts in the state of Minnesota. And then in the governor's recommendation includes $300,000 for the drainage assistance team. And part of that would be a commitment then to that would cover the cost of facilitating the work group and also completing the update to the Minnesota Drainage Manual during the next biennium.
Questions? Is there anybody else who has any other comments on from the public? If not, I think we'd probably, what, call for a motion to leave?
It's not, well, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, it's not a bill. We're just, excuse me, you're right. Thank you, Mr. Knopf. We're just taking testimony. We appreciate
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We just wanted to bring the funding portion here. The bill currently sitting in the Ag Committee with the policy provisions that they would like to see.
That's what we understand. We appreciate the testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Is there anything else to come before this committee? Not the committee's adjourned.